On Monday, one of my children asked me, "Dad, is there still such a thing as real spies in the world?" I'd just been listening to the radio and the news about the former CIA technical worker Edward Snowden and what they thought on Monday would be his escape route from the American authorities. I was only too happy to tell my children that exciting story, which reminded me of my own spy story, which I was even more excited to tell them. Now get this. I was once at an international Christian conference, and the conference had its own website, and the idea was, in participating in the conference, you would also refer to the website as it went along. The problem was, in the first days of the conference, the website was either slow or didn't work at all. I happened to know one of the organisers of the conference, so I went and told her, or said, "Was it known?" And she said, "Not only is it known, but it's sabotage. And the likelihood is, or I think she was absolutely sure, to have be the sabotage that it was, someone would have to be in the conference building to make the sabotage they were making." She told me we suspect Chinese state intervention. Then get this, at this same conference, I was sat on a table with Christian workers, a group of six of us, and we went round and we said where each of us was from and the kind of work we were involved with. Finally, we got to this lady who said she was from Taiwan and was an administrator. We tried to show some interest and asked, "So what do you administrate?" She then said she didn't speak English or couldn't speak any more English and didn't want to say anything more. Happened there was a missionary on our table also who worked in China and spoke Mandarin. And so we offered to translate for her. However, this seemed to be equally embarrassing as we went on to give a bit of testimony and talk about how it was that each of us had become a Christian. The lady said she didn't have anything to say and in the end refused to speak altogether. Then she didn't turn up for the next session. I again chatted to the conference organisers, and they had information, in theory, about which hotel each participant was staying at. And they contacted the hotel, who said they hadn't seen this lady and didn't know where she was then. Well, James Bond that I am, I deduced she was a Chinese spy in our conference pretending to be from Taiwan because she figured that would save her from embarrassing questions about coming from China. Now, I thought this was all very exciting, but the missionary fellow on our table, who'd spoken to her in Mandarin and had told everybody what his work was in China, became very worried. What would happen now? What would happen as he tried to get back into China? Would his entry be blocked? Was this the end of his ministry? As it happens, he did get back into China. But not all of the Christians who should have been at the conference fared so well with the border authorities. It was also the case that 200 Chinese national Christian delegates were blocked participation in the conference. That is, they didn't even get out of China in the first place. Somehow, the Chinese authorities knew about their travel plans and were waiting for them at the airport as they tried to leave China. Now, I think if those Chinese Christians had made it to the conference, they would have been very encouraged because there were Christians from all over the world and there were Christians from the suffering church in Muslim countries, so on and so forth. So potentially great blessing for them. But imagine instead their disappointment. The expense alone of wasted airfares, flights they never made but paid for, the sacrifice of time they'd made just getting to the airport internally in China, and then to be questioned and turned back. And it wouldn't end there, would it? Having failed, but then the fear, knowing for sure you're known to the authorities who are now onto you. For our part, back at the conference, there were 200 chairs with nobody in them. Those chairs were like symbols of the suffering of the Chinese brothers and sisters who couldn't make the conference, because their state is in opposition to the faith they hold. As Peter writes to the Christians in the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia and Bithynia, you get the impression they have some of that coming their way. Peter knows that's what they're facing, and he knows that there's more coming still. It was a pattern in the world of that time. Rome, like power, China is a world power today, had a hardline policy against Christians. Most famously, the Emperor Nero was to be the main persecutor. Persecution was stepping up, and human authorities who were capable of bringing official legal persecution were doing just that. So Peter sets out to encourage Christians in a situation like that to raise their hearts and minds above that situation they see around them, which is so fearsome. Well, today we'll just look at three areas in this passage as Peter encourages them. We'll see Peter instructs them first how to behave in your suffering. That is, how to witness both in what you say and the way you live whilst you suffer. We'll see that suffering is to be expected for the Christian. As we are the followers of the one who suffered, we too will face opposition. Thirdly, in suffering, Peter will call them, as I say, to raise their hearts and minds to the one who suffered before them at the hands of human authorities, but who now himself has all authority, including authority over these powers which oppress the Christians. So there we are then. How to behave in your suffering? Do you expect suffering? And raise your hearts and minds to Jesus. Well, I imagine something has occurred for these people that Peter writes to. They didn't always suffer as they suffer now. And now the suffering has come, they're in the danger of getting lost along the way in their faith. Things have changed around them. The old certainties are not the new certainties. Perhaps when some of us here were growing up, we had to change school mid-term. I wonder if you've ever had to change school perhaps during a term, or certainly you didn't finish your school year and had to go from one school to another. Or even perhaps you can just remember what it was to go from primary school to secondary school. I know my poor children have had to change several times since 2010. And it's quite a challenge every time a child has to change school. You have friendships and you have alliances. You have people who look out for you in the school you were at. You have a general familiarity that lets you know where you stand. In a school, you also have authorities. You have the teachers. You can predict to some extent how a certain teacher will react to certain behaviour. So this is why moving school, the changes in authorities over us, our alliances and our loss of reputation can be so disorientating. Nothing can be taken for granted. New relationships, maybe people ambivalent towards you, maybe hostile towards you. How do you handle that when you change one school to another? How will you react to the people around you? It comes to a lot of adjustment to manage that. Well, Peter is writing to Christians in a situation of new uncertainties in relationships. They can't bank on the authorities protecting them. Quite the opposite. With things now against Christians, both locally and politically, how will they relate to the people around them? See, maybe you think you know your neighbours under one set of circumstances. If Christianity is favoured or things are going okay with the state, your neighbours represent one thing, and your family members who are not Christians, they represent one thing. But what happens in families where suddenly this faith you've got is no longer favoured by the state? What happens with your neighbours when those things happen? Well, Peter's advising them, using Psalm 34, so this is in verse 10 of our passage. This is what you will do. Whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So, dear Christians in Asia Minor, Peter's saying, you're going to have to chase after peace in your life. You're going to have to look for it. You're going to have to work for it. Much the same way as a child who enters a new class in a new situation has to assess the attitude of people around them, Christians in an era of new opposition are going to have to work out all over again how they're going to relate to the people around them and in authority over them. They're going to have to develop some special habits. And first, they're going to practice these habits in the church. So there, verse 8, in the church, they're going to practice being sympathetic, loving one another, being compassionate and humble. And then having learned to live sympathetically, lovingly, compassionately and with humility, they're going to take that out into the world where they will not, verse 9, repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, they will repay evil with blessing. So there's a thought for you. You and I practicing among ourselves what we will then roll out, take out into the world. Sympathy, love, compassion and humility practiced here and then taken out to a world which is watching, where we will go against and resist the temptation to repay evil with evil. Something in us reacts against that idea, doesn't it? I'm nobody's doormat. But there's a couple of temptations. The first temptation might be, we're just going to hide. We're just going to be so indistinct, we're not even going to be recognised as Christians, then we won't face persecution. They won't be able to tell us from the person next to us who's not a Christian. Then we can, as it were, get away with it. Well, being a Christian is not so difficult like that, but it's just not authentic discipleship. It's just not an option for the people, the body of Christ, who have been called to be different. Well, here's another temptation. That is to fight fire with fire. If we do that, if we don't follow Peter's teaching, it could all end up in one great big irony. You see, it's all this living differently stuff that makes us stick out like sore thumbs. It's when we live differently that we're criticised for being self-righteous or hypocritical or whatever it is that people could level at us. It's when we live differently that we are mocked. And the irony would be if we fight back using the same words and attitudes of those who accuse us, we suddenly just start to look like them and we're no longer distinct. You call me a hypocrite? Well, I'll tell you something about yourself. We reply like that. And suddenly it's a victory for the world which is resisting the rule of Christ. Somehow we've ended up going from being distinct to colluding with and behaving the same as the world around us. So instead we should remain distinctive. And Peter teaches these habits which are going to be a strong witness to the world around us. And the psalm that he uses teaches us why we'll do that as well. The word blessing, verse 9, means the calling of God's gracious power and love on all people. This is the calling of love of God on even people who would do us harm. But we are like the Old Testament people of God. The psalm is for Christians themselves will be blessed also when they behave like that. We will inherit God's blessing as we walk the way of the blameless and upright, as we look for and chase after peace with all comers. And then you see, because we're those kinds of people, we will have a credibility that means, verse 15, we may be invited to give an explanation for the hope that is in us. So fearing God instead of the opposition will mean, yes, it means we'll have upright behaviour, but also it will be us getting a chance to articulate our reasons for the faith we hold. And Peter will go on to say more about those reasons in the next section. Well, secondly, I said we should expect suffering. So Peter's been saying how to behave when you suffer. But the reason he's doing that is because he believes that suffering will be an ongoing part of what it is for these people to be Christians. It's true in verse 13, he says, doesn't he? Ultimately, there's no one to harm those who do good. But that does not mean that suffering is not part of the Christian experience. Jesus anticipated suffering, and that suffering would be what those who followed him encountered. The teaching of Paul and the experience of Paul is one of suffering. And the next chapter we'll look at next week of Peter's letter, anticipate suffering. It all tells us that the walk of the Christian is also a wrestle. It's often an uncomfortable walk. It's one that can run into the opposition of state authorities who have behind them, as Paul would say, the powers and principalities. So from the first week of this series, we get the impression that obedience with an element of endurance is what it is to be a member of these churches that Peter writes to. Well, people of St. John's, let us get real also. We need to know that opposition is part of our journey of faith. It's true, the end goal, at the end of time, there will be a great relief from suffering. but it might not let up in our lifetime. So then, suffering is coming. How are you? Do you react to me like me with those struggles? I know I'm inclined to think, in facing opposition, in facing difficulties, this difficulty in front of me is an anomaly. This thing is out of the ordinary. All we need to do is get by it, and then we can get on with the real business of being Christian. Then we'll really get cracking. Well, if these churches take that attitude, they're going to be disappointed. Suffering isn't a stepping stone in this life just to something wonderful around the corner. It is part of their earthly identity as followers of Jesus. Now, it's true, Christians the world over are not all suffering like Christians in Asia Minor. They're not all suffering like the Christians in China. But wherever Christians are, they will face opposition regarding their values and their standards. It's not sounding like much of an advert for Christianity, is it? An invitation to suffer. Well, let's see our third point, how, in spite of all that, Peter gets them to raise their sights above the world and look to Christ. The innocent suffering, verse 18 says Peter, is going to put you in some very good company. And this is what the passage has been building up to. It's an encouragement for people who are likely to suffer treatment, unfair treatment under the authorities, official legal persecution. And this, says Peter, verse 18 onwards, brings you right into line with the Messiah himself, who, of course, suffered at the hands of human authorities. But it's not just that. Peter wants them to see, yes, Jesus suffered at the hands of human authorities, but it wasn't for nothing, was it? It was not meaningless suffering. It wasn't a waste. And Peter wants them to know that their suffering also is not meaningless, and it's not a waste. The message of the suffering of Christ and his victory helps keep us going through dark times. It will keep you and me going on this journey. Look at what Jesus' suffering achieved. After Jesus suffered on the cross, he announced God's victory over all authorities, and especially the ones in heavenly places. So these churches in Asia Minor are having to come to terms with new levels of oppression of human authorities. But those human authorities are not just some random inconvenience. Behind it is this shadowy, unseen realm. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, authorities, powers of this dark world, says Paul. But these powers, but these authorities that are behind the authorities which stand against us, they know their time is coming to an end. Jesus has overthrown their power. Jesus is the ruler. He is sovereign over all the world, all other authorities included. And the Noah references, verses 19 and 20, are about that victory being announced to the rebellious spirits from back in the time of Noah. Now, I admit the chronology when Jesus is making this intervention and telling these spirits is a bit confusing. But in the time of Noah, there were opposing spirits behind the rebellion of people against God. And the power they had was broken as God intervened in Jesus. Ever since the first rebellion of humans, human authorities appeared fearsome due to the fact that they're backed by shadowy forces. So if you took Noah, he's given this mission by God, he's building an ark. If you consider that, the people around him mocking him would have appeared fearsome. And that's because they're backed by the spiritual, a dark spiritual realm. If you then go to the Christians in Asia Minor that Peter's writing to, and they're being oppressed, they're facing real persecution, and that persecution would appear fearsome. And we too, if we ignore what Peter has said to us, the opposition we face will appear fearsome to us. But Noah didn't let what was being said by those around him deter him from God's work and mission in his life, and nor should we. We are being saved, and surely the rebellion against God that appears to be in charge of things has had its notice served. It will be judged, and Christ has triumphed. Well, from spirits at the time of Noah, we get into the floodwaters of the time of Noah. Talking of being saved through water, says Peter, get this for a picture of baptism and Christians being baptized. What marks the Christian out from the rest of the world is the fact that we are baptized as those who are with Jesus in his resurrection. So baptism, if you like, is like a boundary marker. Now, you're going to seek peace, says Peter, but nonetheless, we are in a battle. And we don't need to be ashamed that we're in that battle. We're going to go into it with a good conscience. Our good conscience is, it comes from the forgiveness of sin through Jesus' death. And the fact that in our baptism we are identified, we are seen alongside Jesus and Messiah in his victory. So there's no shame in that. Well, why this week might we need to know all that? Why do we need to hear this message of Peter? Are you and I persecuted like the Christians in Asia Minor or in China? I don't think it's meaningful for us to say that we are persecuted in that sense. We're not being stopped at the borders, are we, as we go to Christian conferences? I think there's a sense in which we are like them, though. And it's more like this child at school who's had to move school and realise that everything has changed. You see, we probably took it for granted, but for the longest time in Europe, Christianity has been favoured. For the longest time in Great Britain, if a person didn't say, well, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Jew, or whatever it was, that wasn't a Christian, it was assumed that nominally that person is a Christian. Laws in Britain for the longest time were in some sense meant to reflect some Christian ethics. But the authorities we live under no longer think that way. For this first time in our lives, our generation is having to adjust to no longer being even nominally as a Christian as a state and society. All that is being swept away. And you and I are having to learn what the rest of the world already knows. They know that if you stand out as a follower of Jesus, you're going to face opposition. You and I are having to come to terms with the idea that politics, art, the media, journalism, all those things, our situation has gone from a cultural familiarity with Christianity. Sure, everybody wasn't Christians, but they'd have some notion of what you're talking about as a Christian when you said who you followed and what your ethics are. Now, perhaps ambivalence or even hostility. How are you and I going to react to our changing situation? What kind of witness are you and I going to be in that situation? Where are we going to get our inspiration and our encouragement? Peter tells us that what we practice in private is going to spill out into the world. So he's saying, practice in church among your brothers certain habits, and then those things will spill out into the world, to a watching world. If by contrast in private, perhaps driving our car this week, we set off late for our appointment, and then someone is blocking our way to making the appointment on time, and we mutter under our breath, our bitterness spills out. Sooner or later, what we're practicing in the car in private will spill out to those around us, to a world which is watching. Instead, Peter shows, verse 8, we need to learn habits among ourselves with other Christians, which will be shown to a watching world, being like-minded, being sympathetic, loving one another, being compassionate and humble. And then in the world, keep your tongue from evil. Seek peace and pursue it. Do not be frightened. Always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that you have with gentleness and respect. Well, with shame, I tell you about my Thursday. On Thursday, I was sat in a country park when about 40 Muslims arrived in the park. And I think deep down in me, I'm recognising that our situation is changing. The religious scene in Britain is changing. And so there's like a reaction of antagonism working away in me as I see these Muslims arrive. And there's two reasons of shame. One is there are probably already 40 pagans in the park who dress like me and look like me, but I didn't react against. But then when the Muslims come and I clearly know, well, they're not Christians or whatever, I start reacting in myself to the religious scene in this country is changing. But it's also not part of my hostility, is not part of God's mission project, is it? Peter's advice to Christian in a world of change and opposition is seek peace and pursue it. To this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. Turn from evil and do good. Even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear, do not be frightened. Well, in finishing, here's one for all of us. How will we respond to the opposition that the church our own local church faces in its projects, like the reordering, for instance. Isn't the temptation to speak the same language as those who oppose us? Do you know Jesus faced human and spiritual opposition before us? Do you know he made a way for us to live with opposition and yet look for peace? And he assures us by his authority from heaven that our suffering at the hands of those who oppose us will not in the end crush us. It's in him we have the victory. Amen.